Hey, so have you heard the rumor that the restaurant guys are introducing a call-in component to the show? Well, guess what? It's true. So if you have a question for the restaurant guys or something you'd like us to discuss on the air, call us at 732-828-9459. Call anytime from anywhere. We'll answer your questions and who knows, maybe even have you on one of our upcoming Restaurant Guys call-in shows. The number to call is 732-828-9459, 732-828-9459 from anytime or anywhere.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hello there, Marky.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well.
I am well, too, and I want to talk about a happy topic. There was a great article in the New York Times recently on the front page of the food section by Oliver Strand. And the article was entitled, Bacchus Keeps His Clothes On. Worst title of an article I've ever encountered.
Can I tell you something amusing just happened in the studio? Literally, Francis's microphone fell into his lap in the middle of that sentence, and it amused me.
Because I tried to follow it with my mouth into my
Francis
lap.
Francis began to go lower, and I finally got back to the mic.
Yeah, you
got to
tighten that screw every once in a while, I guess. Okay, Bacchus Keeps His Clothes On, worst article headline ever. However, it talks about, and it's on the front page of the food section, talks about a trend that I think is awesome. Let me just read a little bit from it. By tradition, a bachelor or bachelorette party is a night of Dionysian excess. However, that unfolds is a matter of taste. For some, it entails a liberating number of drinks and a close encounter with a taut, spray-tanned skin of an exotic dancer. But for one recently married man and his friends, it meant bottles from a good winemaker to accompany the crispy golden skin of a roast suckling pig. Here's a quote, "For the groom, carnal pleasure involved eating," said Archie McAllister, 43, explaining why he reserved the chef's table at the Breslin in Manhattan for a bachelor party he held for Theo Peck, 38, a cook and friend of his. "They brought the pig, and then this slender girl came over and butchered it down and chopped it into little pieces for us. I don't mean this in a leering way, but that was the extent of female entertainment for the evening." It goes on about how they had a great party, and it was all about great food and late-night cocktails, and it talks about how men and women are taking the bachelor and bachelorette party. So one guy flew to El Bulli, which is, you know, this great restaurant just outside of Barcelona. I think
they're making a gastronomic bachelor party instead of a striponomic bachelor party.
Striponomic.
New word.
You know what? I think that should only apply to women who strip with fake breasts.
I think it should be women who strip for the money.
No, that's funny. Because you're thinking economic and I'm thinking animatronic, you know? Well, you know what's funny? I've never understood. Pardon me. I know that it happens all the time. But I've never understood the bachelor party, the standard American bachelor party. I'm about to get married to a woman, and so I go
out. Who I pledged my life and loyalty to.
And so I go out and get so drunk that I'm going to have, somewhere along a broad spectrum from all the bachelor parties I've been to, passing or extremely intimate contact with one or several strippers in front of my friends. First of all, I don't do anything in front of my friends in that arena. So I don't understand that. I really don't.
Well, I think there's a trend here, and there's a trend here for a reason. And I think that part of the reason this is trending this way towards nicer places, and frankly, Francis and I see more and more of these types of events. Part of the reason you have this trend, A, is because people are more into food than they were 20 years ago.
Right.
B, and I think more importantly, is people are getting married older.
Yeah, I think that's definitely
true. So as you're not getting married at 20, 21, 22 years old, you know what? I had a raucous birthday party, 21st birthday party, lots of drinking, you know, woke up, you know, with my shoes off in a place I probably shouldn't have been, and that was my 21st birthday celebration. But and I got married kind of on the younger side, you know, 26, 27 years old, and was one of the first bachelor parties. So there was a it was a drinking frenzy at my bachelor party. But as my friends got older and they got married at 29 and 30 and 32 and 34, well, maybe we went to Chicago to go to a ball game, or we did something else that wasn't just the drinking pornographic frenzy that a lot of these bachelor parties have become. So I think the natural progression there is, you know what? I'm 35 years old. I love great food. Why don't we make my bachelor party be more angled towards that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't really, I'm over strip clubs for whatever reason. I'm over them. Okay. Or I never liked them in the first place.
You never liked them in the first
place.
I
never liked them in the first place, but I'm over them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that wasn't part of my bachelor party. It wasn't part of, and it's, I think the whole drink to excess, party to excess thing, as you get older, becomes less enjoyable.
But
so.
I don't think it's only about being older. I think it's about, like you said, people are more into food. People want to have a memorable experience. And, you know, a lot of the guys are quoted in here saying, yeah, it's just one more drunken evening where I went to a strip club and got drunk with my friends till I threw up.
Right.
What is so special about that? You know what? But if you fly your friends, and some of these guys are saying they spent $1,000 a person on dinner.
Yep.
Which is a lot, but they're talking about New York City. So,
but what I'm going to tell you is I've seen some of these bachelor parties where they go to these expensive strip clubs or whatever where people are spending $500 a piece.
Right. So well, here's what I'm saying, though, is take it out of New York City, because $1,000, you know, they're talking about some of the best restaurants in Manhattan. Take it to a really great restaurant outside in Manhattan.
In, say, New Brunswick.
Yeah. Yeah. You can get away with a lot less than $1,000. And you spend $500 a person, you can have a memorable meal,
right,
and evening afterwards, and cocktails, go to a couple of places.
There may be no naked women in it, but you can have a very memorable evening.
And
with
like you said, Mark, I've seen people spend well in excess of $500 mm-hmm. on bachelor parties.
Sure.
Okay, guys fly to Vegas for their bachelor
right.
party so they can be with a stripper in Vegas. I'm like, are the strippers in Vegas that much better? I mean, you know, can't you get a local stripper in Sayreville or something?
I just want to warn about one thing, because as bachelor parties and these types of things move from some of the seedier places into some of the nicer places, please don't think that you can have a traditional bachelor party in one of these non-traditional places. Because do you remember,
I remember.
Okay, Francis and I worked at a really, really nice restaurant.
Nice place. Still a nice place.
Still a nice place. Still exists. And in this nice place,
owner of a flea market,
somebody rented the top floor of this restaurant, which was open to the bottom floor. So from downstairs, you could see the upstairs.
And they wisely didn't tell us. This is wise if you want to dupe a restaurant. they didn't tell us it was a bachelor party, but we found out about it as the guests began to arrive. And you hear the words bachelor party. We're talking about the other kind of bachelor party, and you think,
this is also 20 years ago.
And you think, oh, no. And we did think, oh, no.
And we were right.
And, oh, no.
Oh, no. I'm sorry, sir. That woman's going to have to put her clothes back on.
It's funny because I was there that night too, and I want to be. I'm sorry, sorry. That woman's gonna have to put her clothes back on in just a minute.
Well, so I'm gonna warn you against having. If you want to have a non-traditional bachelor party in a non-traditional place, that's fine. Don't have a traditional bachelor party in a non-traditional.
Quick
place.
Story: one of the oldest restaurants in New York, lots of private rooms, a place where a steakhouse we go to a
lot. I know the place you're talking about.
My buddy's bachelor party. We were there. And one of the things he said to me was, listen, much like you, and I was the best man at his wedding, and he said, listen, I do not want a stripper. 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 If we want to go to a go-go bar, maybe we can go to a go-go bar. I don't want a lap dance. I don't want a stripper. It's nothing that appeals
to me. Right, I'm getting married because there's only one person that I want
to
be with.
And they never appeal to me anyway. It's just, I don't find it sexy. It's just, I understand, I'm not passing judgment on anybody
right.
else, but this is my bachelor party, and please. And so I'm like, okay, no problem. So I call up this restaurant, who, because they have these private manly rooms, are used to bachelor parties. And I don't know what I was thinking, but I told them it was a bachelor party. And I'm like, okay, listen, first of all, $1,000 security deposit in case you break in. I should have just said it was my Aunt Tilda's birthday party. So, all right, $1,000, and they want it run through, not a guarantee, they want it run through $1,000 in their
hand. With your signature.
With your signature on it. So $1,000, and they all this list of rules. It's a 3-page long list of rules that must have come from what other guys have done. You may not.
It's funny. Francis and I have a lot of policies and procedures for the restaurant. And if you look at Eric Repair's book, he's got a great list of rules for his restaurant that he has in the middle of his book. And Francis and I have all these rules. And people look at us like, no shots. Yeah. No shots. There's a reason for that. No doubles. Yeah. No doubles. I have to wear the exact same shirt as everybody. Yeah. That's, you know, there's all of these rules with all these versions of minutia to them. And they're all because, well, there's a lesson learned.
Well, the rules for the bachelor party were something like, you may not attach to the 34th Street and 7th Avenue sign any sign that says Steakhouse John's Bachelor Party this way. Like, okay, good to know. Can't do that. You may not, you know, have a man in a chicken suit standing outside. You may not have a gorillagram. It was a list of rules, like, and you know everyone came from somewhere.
Oh, absolutely.
So they have $1,000 deposit, and one of the big rules is no strippers. And if you have a stripper, we're going to throw the stripper out, and we keep your $1,000.
That's a rule.
So I'm like, okay, guys, listen, no strippers. And my buddy has this one friend who had a real alcohol problem at that point. He was a real wild man. And he's one of those guys, like a lot of alcoholics, an actor. And he was funny. When he was drunk, he was funny, which was bad for him because people laughed at him.
Right.
And the thing about it was, this guy was, as so many people, I don't know if you deal with alcoholics a lot in your life, I've known a number of alcoholics. This guy, sober, was a nice and funny guy. Starting to get drunk, starting to get lit up, was a really funny guy. He was funny.
Mm-hmm.
After midnight, I don't want to be around this guy.
Right.
I don't want to be around him. His trouble is coming, and it may be funny until... But trouble's coming. There's a fight. Somebody's getting arrested. Something bad is going to be said to him. I just don't want to be
red and blue lights are coming. We don't know if it's the police or the ambulance, but the flashing lights are coming.
So I'm out with this guy, and now this guy's a guest at the bachelor party. And so I'm like, I know that Bob, I'll call him Bob. I know that Bob's a problem, right? So I'm like, listen, everybody, you are not costing me $1,000 over this. And my buddy doesn't want this anyway. So everything's going fine. We're in the private room upstairs at this steakhouse, and in walk three strippers.
Do you lose $3,000 then?
I'm like, what happened? Drunk guy found the strippers coming out of another party in the same restaurant and hired them.
Restaurant's making a fortune on security deposits this day.
Hired them to come into our room. I'm like, you found a stripper? You know, because when he was sober, he had the...
You don't even have references.
When he was sober, he was sober enough not to book the stripper in advance, but he found, like, an a la minute stripper on the street, ready to go, like, in a convenience window. And so the strippers walk in. I'm like, I'm going to kill you, Bob. He's like, I'll pay. I was like, what? He's like, he only had to give him a couple $100 because they were there. Mm-hmm. So he's like, you wanted to work another bachelor party right here? So he gave him a couple $100 each. I'm like, yeah, well, you owe me $1,000 if I lose this security deposit. My buddy was uncomfortable, and I went up to him, and I was like, do you want me to stop this? He's like, no. But we sort of kept it mm-hmm. more tame than the strippers would have really gone a lot further than they did.
Because they're strippers.
Oh, my. You get a lot for $200. They'll do a lot for $200, I'll tell you that much.
It is shocking.
What a bargain. But, yeah, so we kept it in, you know, reasonable, and it was just a show, and it was nothing more than I think they would have charged us extra for all they were willing to do.
Right.
But so that went on for 15 minutes, and they got out of there, and I was – and anyway, the restaurant did not charge me, whether they knew about it or not, and I just – but that was my experience with bachelor parties. Would have much rather gone – but that's what we did. We went out to a steakhouse, mm-hmm. and except for
you
my –
You were having that alternative bachelor party.
There they were. Strippers everywhere, not a drop to drink. And that doesn't make any sense at all.
There was anyway, plenty to drink.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and today our guest is Ben Hewitt. Ben is a farmer from northern Vermont and a writer. His work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Wired, Men's Journal, Gourmet Magazine, and his most recent book is The Town That Saved Food, How a Working-Class Vermont Community Jump-Started Its Economy by Creating a Localized and Innovative Food System.
Ben Hewitt, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Ben, I love your book. It's about this little town that you're. Are you from the town, or you're from near that town?
I live about 8 miles to the east. So the town of Hardwick, that's the subject of the book, is in north central Vermont, and I'm just to the east of that, in the town of Cabot. And some of your listeners might be familiar with the Cabot's award-winning cheddar cheeses.
Yeah, of course, of course. How could we not be? Now, you're originally from up that way?
Yeah, I was born in St. Albans, and, you know, just sort of geographically speaking, St. Albans is actually in northwestern Vermont, and so I was raised in, and that particular portion of Vermont is actually very much a dairy farming region, and so I was raised in sort of the midst of Vermont's dairy industry.
Well, and this area has suffered a great deal of late. Its economy has not been thriving in the new century.
Yeah, well, I mean, in particular, you know, if we want to talk sort of specifically about Hardwick, you know, along with a lot of other sort of small rural communities in northern Vermont, it's just, you know, there hasn't been, you know, there's not a large degree of industry or really any kind of sort of service economy that might, you know, be in place of that industry. So, that, you know, these towns haven't done well. You know, Hardwick in particular has historically for many years had an unemployment rate that's about 40% higher than the state average and a median income that's about 25% lower. And all of this has sort of come on the heels, you know, for Hardwick of a really booming granite industry that faded pretty rapidly in the 1920s. And, you know, since then there's never really been something to sort of come along and sort of put it back on its economic feet, so to speak.
So we have this old community. It's certainly a blue-collar community. It's below the average income for northern Vermont, and the rural farming community is not doing real well. Your book is a fascinating chronicle of how there's a new model of business there that offers some economic hope to this town overall. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, so, you know, I got intrigued and started looking into the story about I'd say about 3 years ago, when I started to sort of notice that in Hardwick there was this incredible number of sort of small-scale, sort of forward-thinking agriculture ventures popping up, and you know, to give you some more specific examples, there was an organic GMO-free seed company. There's a new restaurant and bar that's operating under a community-supported model whereby they actually sold shares of the restaurant to members of the community, and where they're sourcing, at last count, about 80% of their ingredients from within 15 miles. There's an organic tofu and soy milk production facility. Really, that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg. There have been, I would say, in the last 5 years or so, at least six or seven new ventures, and you know, we're talking about a town of 3,200.
Who's...
And also in the broader region, just you know, within a few miles of Hardwick, there are a bunch of other businesses, including you might have heard of Jasper Hill Cheese and the sellers at Jasper Hill.
Yeah, we carry Jasper Hill Cheese in our restaurants.
Yeah, the Crossland Bliss and the Bailey Hazen have both been in our restaurants.
Yeah, there you go. Right. So what I, you know, one thing that really drew me, just as sort of, you know, a writer and a sort of a chronicler of you know, the human condition, and someone who just sort of loves, I guess, contradictions and juxtapositions, was the notion that this little town, you know, which is really sort of, you know, hardscrabble seems to be the word that comes, you know, is associated most with Hardwick, and it's almost become a cliche, but you know, this little hardscrabble town was sort of becoming, you know, the bastion for the local food movement, and sort of being held up as you know, this exemplar of what a localized, you know, food system might look like. And I just sort of love that, because I've always sort of perceived, as a working class Vermonter myself, I've always sort of perceived this whole local food thing as being sort of an upscale concern. So I really appreciated that sort of juxtaposition.
Well, I think we here in this tri-state area, we kind of always think of Vermont as this granola crunching area where people move to kind of be in this kind of a movement, just like you're talking about in Hardwick. But Hardwick really isn't or wasn't that kind of town to begin with. So
that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, it was, you know, a lot of its reputation. Now, let me just say, like, having grown up in northern Vermont and, most people who were raised in northern Vermont have always sort of been aware of Hardwick as this sort of town, his reputation has preceded it. And by that I mean, you know, it's a town with a lot of sort of pretty bad and crude jokes at his expense. And I think a lot of that came out of this, you know, this booming granite times when there was a tremendous amount of immigrant labor, and this was sort of a work hard, sort of play hard type of town. And it's actually, the rumor was that in the early 1900s there were more bars per capita in Hardwick than any town in North America. And so it was a place of, you know, a lot of wild Saturday nights. And just never really shed that reputation. And then, of course, after the granite industry went away, it sort of entered this period of sort of, I guess, economic stagnation would be, probably the most appropriate term. I don't really want to call it economically depressed, because it's not really that different from, in some ways, from a lot of small, I think, rural Vermont communities, and probably, you know, rural communities across the U.S., and it also is a community, I think, that it, in a lot of ways, is really vibrant and healthy. So it's really just, you know, when we look at some of these economic numbers, where it sort of has traditionally fallen short. But, you know, it is definitely a working class community, and all through the sort of middle 1900s, 1950, 1960, there was a lot of dairy farming going on. And then in about the 1970s, Hardwick really got hit by the back to the land movement. It became a real sort of beacon to folks who were sort of looking for a way out. And there was a real sudden and sort of strong influx of back to the landers. And I think one of the things that has really sort of, I guess pun intended, sowed the seeds for what's going on now was this sort of influx of young, agriculturally minded folks who wanted to sort of seek a different direction than, you know, strictly dairy farming. And then there was the Buffalo Mountain Co-op was founded in 1975, which actually now makes it one of the oldest operating food cooperatives in the U.S.
So,
just an interesting little anecdote that sort of really to me sums up a lot about what Hardwick's about is that when the Buffalo Mountain Co-op opened, it was in the same building as a gun shop and a liquor store.
Love it. Love it.
So, you one-stop shopping Hardwick style. You could go get your tofu, your Jim Beam, and your .357 Magnum, you know.
All right, so
well,
30 years...
Tofu, I'm sorry, I just have to interrupt. Tofu's never better than when you serve it on caribou, you know.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, it certainly, as far as I'm concerned, needs some fat to go along with it, but yeah.
So 30 years on, what's the makeup of this food revolution that's going on there? These people, I'm sure, were viewed with some degree of skepticism back in the 70s when they, when these hippie back to the landers came into this hard scrabble town of dairy farmers. What is it now? Are they the old timers now, or is there still a newcomer old timer divide?
That's really interesting. That's a great question. I mean, from what I observe, there is some divide. I clearly see what's going on now as being a little bit of a different, or I guess an evolved articulation of what we've thought of as agriculture, clearly in this country, and I think even in Vermont to a certain extent. And I think Vermont has always been associated with, very much with like dairy farming and maybe maple syrup production. And what we're seeing now, I sort of call it the agripreneurial revolution, and it's really a lot of young, mostly guys, in their 30s, very business savvy, very entrepreneurial minded, and really sort of, applying those talents to agriculture. And so you've got a lot of, value added products, hence like Jasper Hill, hence the tofu. And you also have, a certain sort of mission-driven ethos that, is seeking to sort of find, I think, I'm not hugely fond of the term sustainable, because I think it's been overused, but it's definitely seeking to find some solutions and some sort of systems thinking approaches to making, our agriculture system something that can, it really can stick around for a while. One example of that is perhaps what Jasper Hill is trying to do, and they've put in this really, I don't know how much you know about what they've got going on up there, but they've put in this incredibly impressive aging facility that that really they're only making a small percentage of the cheese themselves that they eventually hope to have in this facility, and their hope is that they can convince some of these dairy farms up here that are struggling so profoundly right now to actually start making cheese themselves, and then Jasper Hill can provide the sort of aging and marketing facilities and savvy to put that out on the market.
You know, my friends and I used to go up to Vermont every year, and one of the things that was always a highlight of the trip, we go up to either to ski or we would go up during the summertime and just kind of hang out in the woods and in the quiet peace and quiet, well, in a house in the woods. we're not big outdoorsman types, but one of the most fun parts of the trip would always be go to one of the towns and go to one of the cheese shops that featured all of the cool Vermont cheeses. There are so many really interesting Vermont cheeses up there, and so many of these great dairy farms that are still there. I think it would be awesome if Jasper Hill could get them all to kind of come together in one place and really show off what they can do.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's a model that works in other countries. I mean, that's something that happens, you know, it happens in France, it happens in other, mostly European countries. You know, the problem in Vermont, I think, is you've got all of these, sort of reticent, you know, farmers who are not, you know, that do not necessarily embrace, change and a new way of doing things. So I think, you know, if I read between the lines a little bit, I think it's been a little bit slower going than they would like to sort of convince some of these guys to come over to the cheese side of things. But that said, I know that they have actually, they have been bringing in some new farmstead operations, and they're definitely hoping, I think, eventually they have the capacity to age something like 2 million pounds of cheese a year, which really puts them in, you know, very sort of rarefied territory for that sort of level of artisan cheese production.
Well, you talk about a value-added product, and I think that's one of the things that one of the things that's most interesting about this town is that there is all this cooperation among these many individual entrepreneurs. But I think one of the things that small farmers increasingly find it hard to do, no matter what sort of agricultural product they're trying to produce, is small farmers aren't very good ever at producing a commodity crop. You can't produce cattle corn as cheaply as a big farm in the Midwest. You can't produce, ground beef, low quality ground beef as cheaply as somebody else. But it's when you look to artisanal products and value added products that I think that's where the lowest common denominator doesn't hold, and a sense of individuality does add some value. And this comes back to a central theme of our whole show, which is that good taste is important, and that having good taste and having a desire for Jasper Hill Farms cheese and liking Bailey Hayes and Blue and realizing, whether you saw it on the cheese board in one of our restaurants or your local gourmet cheese shop, and saying, wow, that's amazing, I want to have that again, I think good taste is inextricably tied to what makes this engine go. I mean, do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. I mean, you know, these guys are clearly producing, world-beating products. And your point on, about the challenges facing, small-scale farmers who, might try to compete on a commodity market. I mean, clearly we have, a larger nationalized or actually internationalized food system that really all but makes that impossible. But it's also, it also sort of brings me to one of the central theses in my book, too, which was that, there's been so much talk about and media coverage on Hardwick, and how it's they're developing this sort of, healthy, localized food system. And I'm really struck, by the sort of, I guess, irony is the right word, in the fact that, a lot of these products that are being produced here are, sort of beyond the means, or at least perceived to be beyond the means of a local population where the median income is less than $15,000. I really spent a lot of time in the book sort of, kicking that can around a little bit. It's like, do we look at these local food systems as, are they economic drivers for their community, or, you know, should there be some sort of mandate to be producing, you know, a certain percentage of the food as nourishment for the community? And,
there's
you know, the tricky thing is, of course, is that, you know, we have a system right now that pits, you know, the viability of the producer against the means of the consumer to afford it on a small scale. And you know, I sort of naively and presumptuously figured that I would figure out exactly what that magic what the magic bullet is, the silver bullet is, and of course I never really got there. It's a very, very complex issue.
I think that we haven't gotten there as a society as a whole and in this movement as a whole, and I think I want to come back on the other side of the break and kick that can around a little bit more, because it's a pretty troubling paradigm, but I think that the only way out is through. But we'll be back in just a moment and talk more with Ben Hewitt about his book, The Town That Saved Food, How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on 1450 WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're talking with Ben Hewitt about his book. I misstated the book at the closing at the out before. I said that it was The Town That Saved Food. Indeed, the name of the book is The Town That Food Saved, but that's a I got to keep myself from making that mistake every time I talk about the book, Ben.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think there's, you know, when I heard you say that, I sort of had a chuckle to myself, because you're probably about the fifth or sixth person who's you know, sort of flipped those words around, and I'm sort of realizing, and actually I mentioned this in the book really briefly, in that I think in some ways it's almost a more accurate title, you know, because when you think about what is going on with our industrialized agriculture system and really, you know, the ways in which it's, you know, really, I believe, predatory on, you know, our environment, our communities, on just about every level, I feel like it's predatory. And you know, you see, you know, what's going on in Hardwick and the potential I think it has and the inspiration that it sort of seems to be, you know, sowing around the country for other communities, you can really start to see that it actually may be the town that saved food. I mean, if we really, you know, believe, and I do believe that we need to be moving very urgently, you know, toward these decentralized food systems, and if this is the town to sort of help show us how that might work, I think actually you've got the better title.
Well, you know, there's a lot of reasons to talk about decentralized food systems. I mean, if you want to appeal to the alarmist in us, food security being one of them. I mean, it's the way we work is unsustainable in many ways, and we can talk about that in a moment, but that's something we've dealt with in the show before. But one of the interesting paradigms that no one has really solved yet is something that you touched on at the end of the last segment, where when we have, in some cases, poor farmers who work very hard to create food for rich people to eat, while the poor farmer can't afford to eat in that strata of food that even they create, or the workers on the farm can't afford to eat that strata, and maybe eating, you know, Burger King and McDonald's, which is nutritionally not as dense as or as good for you as the kind of food we're talking about, is that rich person, you know, your average person can't afford to shop at Whole Foods, and Whole Foods is great. I can afford to shop at Whole Foods, and I do, and it's a great store. How do we resolve that paradigm that the obesity epidemic, the diabetes epidemic, is most concentrated in our poorest communities that have the least ability to take advantage of $20 a pound Jasper Hill Farms cheese?
Yeah, that's way too hard a question. I'm not going to be able to answer that. So, honestly, I tell people straight up, if they're looking for a book that's got all sorts of neat little answers, this is not the book for them. This is really a book about questions. Although I believe that, we've gone so far in, one particular direction that's not really working for really anyone but a handful of, international conglomerates. I feel like the first step towards sort of turning that ship around is actually even figuring out what questions we need to ask, And so I don't have, a neat pat answer to that. I would like to just talk a little bit more about that very question. Thank God we're finally starting to even ask that question, which is not something that's been part of our, national dialogue until, really quite recently. And I think, again, it was like sort of one of the things about this town that made me really intrigued is that, because of its relatively low income, I was it really brings those issues into really sharp focus, it is this sort of whole issue of how can we bring sort of basic foods to these communities at a price they can afford, because obviously there is room for those value added products like $20 per pound cheese or whatever, or artisan, tofu or whatever it is. But, clearly we need, if we want to talk about some level of affordability, we're probably talking about, producing some more sort of basic products. And there is no real easy path to it. I think there are a number of ways to chip away at it. Clearly on a national level, we have an agricultural subsidy system that is working against us, and so we might consider ways that we can subsidize. Pollen has suggested that perhaps food stamps should count double at farmers markets. That seems to me like a pretty sane response rather than paying farmers.
Before our listeners on the right go a little off on there they go talking about subsidies again. What we're talking about is an unequal playing field, because the corn and soybeans that go into make the processed food, believe you me, everybody, are subsidized and discriminated in favor of by the policy of the United States government, and the regulatory bodies are almost entirely captured by the, handful of very large food companies that are as powerful as the very large oil companies. You just don't know their names, perhaps.
And what's amazing is to consider how quickly it's happened. In 1900, Kraft Foods wasn't even founded till 1903, and in their first year of operation, Kraft Foods lost 3,000 and a horse.
Lost what? I'm sorry, you broke up right there. They lost what?
They lost $3,000 and a horse. That's what they listed on their tax return as their losses, right? And now they're, a $40 billion company.
Billion with a B.
With a B, yeah. So, Monsanto didn't exist in 1900. All of the giants, really, of our food industry either were in their absolute infancy or simply didn't exist 100 years ago.
And again,
this has happened incredibly quickly. And you're absolutely right. It's a totally unlevel playing field, both in terms of actual sort of, cash subsidy handouts, but also in terms of, some of the techniques and the gross inputs that the industrial system, food system uses to produce food. And by that I mean that, none of this is possible without, huge inputs of cheap fossil fuel energy, which, of course, in and of itself is subsidized on many different levels.
Just remember, and I want to make this very, very clear for our listeners, the farm subsidies, we always hear about the farm bill and how we have to help the farmers, et cetera, and so forth. The lion's share, above the 90th percentile, of that farm subsidy goes to huge corporations that form commodity crops and grow things that you don't eat. And so were you wondering how your hamburger got to be 79 cents? Well, it got there because these corporations take a huge amount of welfare, a huge amount of regulation, a huge amount of laws that allow them to externalize their costs. And the guy who grows tomatoes and potatoes and green beans at the green market, he's not getting those government subsidies. And in fact, here's a great irony. You know what the Department of Agriculture calls those crops? They're called specialty crops. Isn't that crazy?
Nice.
Isn't that nice?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was saying what we eat is a specialty crop, and they dress it up with a picture of a farm like we're helping the farmers. You're not helping the farmers. You're helping Cargill, but you're not helping the farmers. The farmers, we should switch it. And those big companies are producing this food that is causing health problems and land problems. If that stuff is profitable, then it shouldn't need our government money. And we gain no great ability by having those people. There's no great value to the nation that comes from that. The value to the nation would be mid-sized farms growing specialty crops to feed us locally. And that's where if the same level of farm subsidies were switched and we turn off the spigot to the hugest, richest companies in America and had that same level of spigot go to the small farmers, you would see a flowering across this nation of local sustainable farms, and it's just disgusting that it's not happening.
Wow, that was a wonderful little rant. And, you know, I mean, it all sounds so common sense. It's like, why are we not doing it, you know? It's
lobbyists.
Like, who can argue with that? And I do. You make a really good point, and one thing that I really want to stress, too, is that none of what we're talking about here is an indictment of, you know, some very, very hardworking, you know, large-scale farmers. I mean, my grandparents grew hundreds of acres of corn and soybeans in Iowa, and I know how hard they worked, and you know they were clearly part of this you know sort of broader industrialized system we're talking about. So, you know, but they were just as much, and all of these farmers who are growing, you know, these 100 acres of corn and soybeans and sort of, you know, forced into this system are really just as much, I believe, you know, sort of victimized by the system as are these people in these communities who you know can't get good nutritional food for a decent price. Back to the cost issue a little bit. I mean, you know, the ways I think to chip away at this, you know, are, you know, one, you know, bringing this food as just shortening the supply chain, basically. I mean, anytime that you can go directly to a farmer and buy food directly to a farmer, either at a farmer's market or maybe through a food cooperative, which is one small step removed, You're just taking, you know, numerous hands basically out of the pie who are you know each want their little handful of coin. So, you know, that's certainly one way. You know, I also think, you know, I love the notion that people in this nation are getting inspired themselves to actually put their hands in the soil. I mean, I think gardening is up something like 20% in the last year. You know. And we now are on our way to being a nation of gardeners, and you know that's clearly a way to turn a very inexpensive product, you know, seeds into you know, you could, for $20 or $30 worth of seeds, you can grow literally hundreds of dollars worth of vegetables. And you know, obviously that's not a solution for everybody, but it is a solution for a lot of people out there.
And one of the key points for me in reading the book, I'm sitting there and I read this section of, in the 1800s, 90% of us lived on farms, and today 0.7% of us live on farms. So we went from 90 out of 100 to 1 out of 140 people living on farms.
That's correct.
That's a huge, huge difference. And maybe part of this problem is we need more people to be toiling in the soil, whether it's in their little garden or whether it's on their little one-acre farm or whether it's on their mid-scale family farm.
You know, I 100% agree with you. And you know, I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with someone who is sort of, you know, a host who was sort of arguing, but you know, but it's such hard work. And, you know, I don't think, you know, people don't want to do that. You're still talking, you know, and I actually don't believe that's true. I mean, I think that people right now in this country are, I mean, you know, not everybody, but we don't need everybody to go there, you know. But I think, you know, look at the last USDA farm census. There was actually a growth in the number of farms in the U.S. for the first time in I don't know how long. But almost all of that growth was in small farms. And, you know, people are wanting to do this. They do want to do it. They just want to know that if they are going to make that leap, you know, there's going to be a market for them, and there's going to be some sort of level of viability there.
The other thing about a lot of these family farms that I see is they're not all about just growing 500 acres of corn. They're about growing different crops at different times of the year and having some animals on the property. You know, I'm seeing more and more of that in these smaller
diversification.
Farms. Diversification,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think there's a really sort of growing awareness that, look, when I describe our farm to people, the way I describe it is, you know, it probably looks like a turn of the century Vermont hill farm, but not the most recent turn of the century. You know, I mean, and so if you look back, you know, 100 years or so, all of these farms, you know, were diversified farms. They had some milk cows. They might have run some beef. They used the fertility that came out the back ends of those critters to compost that and put it on the vegetable garden. They might have grown enough extra in the vegetable garden to sell at a market. You know, they did some berries. I mean, the diversification, I think, is key on a number of fronts. One, it does allow you to create a cycle within your farm so that if you have the animals and you can capture that fertility and put it on to your land, either to grow vegetables or a hay crop for your critters, you're then not dependent on inputs, you know, fertility inputs, which is a huge issue. And it also means that you're less beholden to one particular crop, you know, having a bad year. So, you know, if you're growing corn and wheat and soy or whatever it is, and one of those you have a bad, you know, one of those crops is a failure, well, you're probably not going to go under. Whereas
right.
If you had all of your land sown to corn and you had a bad year or the market bottoms out or whatever, you know, you're really vulnerable.
And to go back to that point we were making earlier about a lot of these products being outside the price range of the people who are producing them. You know, maybe one of the answers that a lot more people are producing a lot more different things, and there's a barter system that can come into play there with some of these products for some of these poorer people.
Yeah, I think, you know, it will be interesting to see how that evolves in town here. I mean, there have been a lot of efforts. You know, one of the things that I wrote about a little bit in the book was this effort at High Mowing Seeds where they harvest all the seeds out of these pumpkins and squash, but then, you know, they just want the seed. And so the perfectly good sort of flesh of the vegetables is left to rot, or had traditionally been left to rot. And a couple of years ago, they started sort of going through the field and actually, you know, pulling some of that out of the fields. And with that, what they've done is started a program called Pies for the People, whereby the local agriculture college cooks those ingredients that would otherwise have gone to waste, and has turned them into pies, which they distribute during the holiday season to families in need. So that's just one small example of, working. I call it working the margins. You know, here's something that would otherwise have sort of gone to waste, and you're turning it into a highly nutritious foodstuff for the local citizenry. And also, I don't want to disparage these companies for taking this value added, running with this value added model. I mean, you know, they do need to create some sort of financial viability, and you know, the jobs that they're bringing to the community are not, you know, listen, this is important stuff. You know, we need these jobs. So so there's clearly, you know, I think a gray area here. But I do think that we always want to be looking at ways, if we want to talk about, you know, true, you know, equality and access to nutritious food, we do want to really be looking hard at ways that we can bring this food back into our community.
And Ben, I want to thank you for naming our next pastry book is definitely going to be called Pies for the People.
Thanks
very much.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I by raising the issue earlier, and I do think it's an important issue and an important question, of the fact that a lot of the organic food is and a lot of the food that we're talking about producing in a sustainable way is not accessible to poor people who can't afford it. I don't view that as an indictment of these companies at all. I think the only way out is through. And the first thing we need to do is to create a sustainable business that can practice sustainable agriculture. Because if you practice sustainable agriculture for a number of years and you can't make enough to pay the bills and bring jobs into the community and make a sustainable business, well then you're nowhere. Then you've done nothing.
Yeah, it's not going to do anybody any good if you go out of business after a year.
But then I think what's happening in Hardwick and what you detail in your book is then people who have these, you know, businesses that are sustained on the high end stuff are looking for ways to sort of democratize food in that town, and it is a concern and a goal, and you detail that in the book rather beautifully, and they haven't quite figured out how to do it, which is another thing. I think it's great that you are asking questions that don't necessarily don't have the answer yet, but they are looking to feed the town sustainably with the food. Yeah, and I think that's an admirable goal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Vermont has always been, you know, an exporter of agricultural products, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. But, you know, I do think it behooves us to sort of begin to, you know, as I sort of, you know, I guess I keep hitting this point because I think it's really important, but, you know, we really, I think, should be looking at, I think we should be looking at the food we produce as a really, really valuable resource rather than, you know, a commodity put out on the open market. And, you know, what are the ways that we can sort of begin to husband this resource and you know, not to be selfish, but, you know, come on, these are our communities. These are the people that we should be most concerned about, and as it should be in every community across this country. And, you know, how can we keep more of that there while providing that same viability? And listen, the consumers certainly bear some brunt of responsibility here, because I think, you know, I talked earlier about, I said that people either can't afford or perceive they can't afford this food, and I do think that in some cases it's a perception more than a reality.
Well, and I also want to point out one thing that you said about, you know, we can't afford to put this food in the open market. First, that food can't be completely on the open market, and I'm going to agree with you, and I'm going to put this out from time immemorial, from prehistory. One of the reasons that civilization happened was so that one of the responsibilities of any emperor, any king, any democracy, any commonwealth was to stave off famine, okay? And the open market does not stave off famine, okay? So food has, it's a necessity. It's a right. You have a right to air, water, food, to live, okay? So, and there's not always going to be enough if we don't act in concert together to make sure there's always going to be enough, and the invisible hand of the market doesn't always work with agriculture. So that's a myth. We've never in the world in history had an open market, except for the Irish potato famine. That was an example of the open market working on food. And, you know, from the country from which my ancestors hailed, you know, a quarter of the population died of pestilence. While Ireland was a net exporter of food. That, my friends, is the free market with food. If you like the Irish potato famine, that's the free market with food.
Right, and, you know, look at what's going on in this country right now. I mean, we waste the sum total of about 40% of our food goes into trash, right? It's not even, I'm not even talking about waste in terms of, like, we're not even composting it and turning it into some kind of fertility. We're just trashing it, basically. And yet we have a record number of Americans on food stamps. I mean, you know, we've got, you know, our systems are so, you know, sort of backwards and really working against the general populace. It's really quite stunning, you know, that it's evolved in this way. I mean, consider that, you know, just what you're talking about, you know, with that in the 1800s, you know, it was the U.S. government that actually provided seeds to all of its population because they wanted them to be able to grow some food.
It's a fundamental promote the general welfare is right up there with provide for the common defense, and it is what all societies have always done. Is first thing is make sure we're safe, and then make sure everybody gets enough to eat. That's why human beings come together.
It's basic.
And one other thing I want to say, because I know I'm going to get millions of emails from my free market friends, and I believe in a free market in many things, in many environments, and in many ways. I believe in a tempered free market. But don't talk to me about how I'm against the free market and I want to dismantle the American free market when it comes to food. There is no American free market when it comes to food. We regulate in favor of large corporations, and then we subsidize them with millions of dollars. Billions of dollars every year, and then we regulate the rest of us in such a way that they're allowed to externalize their costs and communalize their costs and socialize the costs while retaining all the profits. You know, the profits are private sector, but the costs are socialized. So
I'm really struck by how it sounds exactly like what's going on with our financial system right now. You know,
it is striking, and it's more important because you need food to live. You cut off the food. You know, if you cut off the oil, we can still survive. If you control the oil, I can still wiggle some private space for myself. If you control the food, I can't make it to next week.
But you know, I think what's really amazing is that as a population, how quickly we've sort of forgotten that. I mean, it's gotten really so easy and you know cheap. I'm going to say cheap in quotation marks there because there are all these external costs that you know we're not considering. But you know, we perceive it to be so cheap and so easy right now to feed ourselves. And that's really an incredibly recent phenomenon. I mean, that's you know, this is not something that is sort of you know a situation that has endured for millennia. I mean, we're talking about really only over the last you know three quarters of a century, or even less, really, that it's just gotten.
You're really talking about one or two generations.
Yeah,
exactly. And you know, I think we've already come to this place where we all sort of believe that. You know, we've forgotten that that might have once been another way, and we have this sort of abiding faith that this is the way it's always going to be. And
well, even
you know,
if
I think that's really dangerous.
And even if you look at how corporations have co-opted the language, you go into the supermarket, and the conventionally grown vegetables are the vegetables with pesticides and herbicides and all sorts of stuff in them and growth hormones. That's conventional,
right.
And the special stuff. Is the tomato that was planted in the ground and grown by a guy without the use of chemicals. What?
Yeah, well, you know, this is the very reason that I, in my own, you know, speech and my writings have almost entirely stopped using the word sustainable because, you know, as soon as I saw, you know, not to pick on Monsanto, but what the hell, I mean, they kind of deserve it. You know, as soon as I saw them running a sustainability ad campaign, you know, I sort of realized that we've reached this point where, you know, of near meaningless, you know, regarding this particular term and that, you know, We just don't as a culture take the time to sit down and maybe we just don't even know how to really think about these things and really sort of you know see through this sort of veil of you know marketing speak and this sort of new vernacular.
Ben, I'm going to just disagree with you slightly there.
I think
the word sustainable is totally fine. I think it's been stolen and misused by a lot of people. And so what I want to do is kind of take the word back.
I'm willing to fight for sustainable.
I want the word back. I want my word back.
Because here's what happens. We come up with organic, and then then organic standards get passed in the government, and then the corporations lobby to say, well, organic can have a little bit of chemicals in it, and, well, that chemical is good, and all of a sudden organic is meaningless. Well, you know, we can't keep inventing new words and building up a market for these new words and then letting the corporations have them. Sustainable means it's sustainable, means it doesn't use a lot of fossil fuels, means you can do it for 1,000 years, okay?
Let me ask you then, what is, you know, how long can you do you have to be able to do something to make it sustainable?
I'll settle for 500 to 600 years, and that I will consider that sustainable. Was that
my
work for
argument,
you?
Yeah, I think so, although my argument, you know, and here you get into even more, a more difficult conversation, but I'm not certain that there is a form of agriculture that is truly sustainable that is actually going to feed 6-point-whatever billion people on this planet.
You know, it's funny. There have been some studies that have come out just recently that have talked about the density of food that comes out of large, high-input agriculture farms. It turns out in the last couple of years there are a bunch of studies that say mid-size organic diversified farming is the most productive farming that we can have. Isn't that crazy?
I believe that.
So, you know what? I hear all the time these big corporations talk about how, oh, we need genetically modified crops or we won't be able to feed anybody. I don't see these genetically modified crops feeding the world. And from farmers that I talk to, their actual output yields in the field don't seem to be any higher to me. And Monsanto and all these big companies do not allow, by law, you may not study them whether they actually deliver on their promises or not.
Right.
So there's no way to verify what they do. What we know is that Roundup Ready crops make you buy more Roundup.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, that's part and parcel of the, you know, the engineering of these particular crops is that they're basically engineering them to require another product that they'll be happy to sell you.
Well, and the other thing about genetically engineered crops, as long as we're onto that topic of things, is you know, genetically for millennia, from the times humans first became farming communities, we plant, we grow, we save seeds. The government in America used to consolidate and supply seeds for our farmers, but you could save your own seeds and replant. Well, with genetically modified crops, you can't. You have to go back to Monsanto every year for all of eternity to buy its patented GMO seeds.
And I know that you mentioned the Terminator seed in the book. You want to just talk about that for a second, Ben?
Yeah, so Terminator is, the Terminator technology was the technology that was developed by Monsanto and patented in the, I believe it was 99 or the late 90s. And it's basically, you know, here's the thing with seeds. When you sell seed, you're basically not only selling this, if you sell just a regular sort of open pollinated, not modified seed, you're not just selling the seed, but you're selling the factory, because that seed will then grow a plant that's going to produce seed, which then you can save if you choose to grow your seed, to grow your crop the next year. And this is the way it was done
forever.
10,000 years or
forever.
Whatever.
We'll say forever.
Yeah, basically forever. I mean, since we started cultivating. And so what's happened now, of course, has been this movement toward, first you start having hybrid seeds, which you can save, but you're not always certain. And I'm not saying hybrids are bad. There's some very, very good things about hybrid seed. And a hybrid seed is just a seed, it's been pollinated. Usually it's cross-pollinated with other varieties to create enduring traits, positive traits of a particular crop. But what happens when you save hybrid seeds, sometimes you just don't know exactly what you're going to end up with. You might end up with, corn that's going to grow, two-inch ears with pink kernels or something like
right,
that.
Right,
right. And now what's happening is that, Monsanto now has this technology called Terminator technology, which is actually sterile seed. So it'll grow a plant, but that plant or that crop will not reproduce seed. It absolutely, it puts seed saving out of the picture. You just cannot do it. Now, they have not yet implemented. There was such an outcry when they took out the patent on this stuff and sort of, it came out that they had this technology, that they have basically it stuck to a self-imposed vow not to utilize the technology. But that very, they are also keeping their options open, let's put it that way. They have not said that they will never use the technology, but for the time being, they are keeping it under wraps.
Well, and also, if your neighbor uses their genetically modified seed, and then that plant cross-pollinates with one of your plants, and some of that DNA winds up on your farm, Monsanto will sue you, will send you a licensing fee and tell you to pay them a ton of money.
Yeah, and they have investigators out in the field, literally in the field, checking for people who are somehow infringing upon their patents. And as you just pointed out, people can unknowingly be infringing upon a Monsanto patent and still be liable.
Right,
so
well.
it's really stunning what the power that's been amassed and consolidated. And it's not just Monsanto. They certainly are the 800-pound gorilla. But, in the seed industry, I think it's the top three seed companies own 50% of the market. So the consolidation is really tremendous. And Monsanto actually owns, because now you can sell the genetics to another seed company. Monsanto owns, by some estimates, as much as 90% of the corn and soy genetics in the U.S. seed market.
All right, I'm frightened to death now. I hope you are as well. But if you want to go to someplace that's doing positive things with food, you might want to check out Hardwick, Vermont. The book is The Town That Saved Food, How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food. Its author is Ben Hewitt, and you can find out more about it on restaurantguysradio.com. Ben, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Ben.
Hey, thank you. It's also it's The Town That Food Saved. You did it one more time.
I know. I just can't stop it. So it's going to help everybody remember it when they go. We'll get it right on the website, I promise. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com. You know, restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass, but I often find that a great glass of wine I order in a restaurant comes to me flat or even spoiled. It's been my experience as a restaurateur that wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. Now, Mark and I have searched for 20 years, and we finally found a wine preservation system that does work, the Infinity System for Restaurants and Bars. Vinfinity keeps bottles of wine tasting fresh for weeks. It's got 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. It never needs gas, it takes up very little room, it's easy to install, easy to use, and virtually maintenance-free. And the bottles don't need to stay attached to the machine, so one Vinfinity can preserve an infinite number of wines. We now offer dozens of wines by the glass at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, and because of Vinfinity, we know that every glass is right when it comes to you. Tell your favorite restaurant about the Vinfinity system. If you own a restaurant or bar, buy it. Go to VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953 and tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Sorry I got a little riled up there, Mark. I feel like I...
It's basically that's the topic that really gets you fired up.
I need a Xanax. I hope it got some of you out there in listener land tied up. You know what? I found an interesting statistic, but I was going to keep him on the show forever, and we ran out of time. So, but there's a crazy juxtaposition when you talk about a crazy government policy. And let's, again, remember, there is no free market when it comes to food. We're just debating the terms of the non-free market. And since we don't have a free market, we why not make it a fair market, okay, with some competition for small people and
because
a diversified
because
market.
Small farmers don't have the same kind of lobbyists that the large
That's exactly right. But if you want to look at the craziness of our food system, I thought that Michael Pollan's make food stamps count for double at farm stands.
That'd be awesome.
I mean, that's tremendous. Well, you know, here's a statistic. And this is sort of makes sense if you think about the correlation of obesity and poverty. Our poorest neighborhoods are the places where you're least likely to able to get organic or even whole foods. Like, you know, mm-hmm. who is it they said?
An apple,
right. Things that don't have an ingredients list, things that are ingredients. You know, apples, oranges, bananas, pears, and good food. Those are called food deserts where you don't have – but you have a lot of cheap processed food there. So – in our poorest places, we have the highest incidence of consumption of fast food and the most processed food, which is where we have the fattest people, the highest incidence of obesity, the highest incidence of morbidly obese people, the highest incidence of diabetes and obesity-related diseases. These are also the neighborhoods that have the highest concentration of people on food stamps. Isn't that crazy? We're subsidizing people in just all the wrong ways, you know?
The last thing we want to do, if somebody told you you're going to subsidize somebody so they can go to McDonald's.
Right.
I mean,
well, and food stamps don't subsidize McDonald's, but they subsidize people who...
I understand.
It's crazy.
But if somebody told you these are the choices that are available to, I don't even want to say that they're making, that are available
sure.
to the people that you're subsidizing as you pay your taxes and
right. And then you subsidize their health care. You subsidize their health care with diabetes.
There's no chance that you wouldn't be outraged.
Well, and I don't know, it's a crazy situation. And when people say, oh, well, you know, food would be more expensive. You know what? Certain types of food will inevitably be more expensive if we take away the government subsidies that make it cheaper, and we raise it in a more sustainable way. But you know what? Beef is one of those things that's going to get somewhat more expensive. And so who knows? The price of beef could be 2 or 3 times more expensive than, you know, your inexpensive McDonald's beef. But you know what? Fortunately, there's an obesity epidemic. we eat 2 or 3 times as much beef as we possibly should. So eat less but better and eat more vegetables. I mean, we just came back from Italy, and all the plates had some meat in the center and surrounded by greens and vegetables, and they're healthier than we are.
And it was spectacular.
Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys as much as we have. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.